sacred thing in life isn't the path. It's the freedom to choose it. Freedom is the roar of one man's engine and the silence of another's. So choose, but choose wisely. Choose what makes you happy. My friends, my family, my work make me happy. This Jeep makes me happy, even though my name is
Hey, I'm Daniel, one of the founders of Ridge. My dad and I realized that most wallets are falling apart, stuffed to the max, and barely fit in your back pocket. So we set out to create something better. Ridge is built to last a lifetime and is the perfect balance of modern style and durability. Find yours at Ridge.com.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Chris Pratt here. I know you're in the middle of something, but I was wondering if you could just read a little bit of scripture together real quick. From the book of Joshua. I command you, be strong and steadfast. Do not fear, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Join me in diving deeper into the Bible and praying every day on Hallow. You got to check it out.
When a cyber thief transfers the title of your home out of your name, it's a race against time to stop the theft of your hard-earned equity.
Many people don't know this has happened until long after it's done.
You as the homeowner think you still own a house. 3 months later, you start getting foreclosure notices and you realize you've got four mortgages on your house that you didn't even know existed.
So when's the last time you checked on the title to your home? Find out if you're already a victim at HomeTitleLock.com.
Ever worry that you're drinking too much? Take back control with Or Health. Or Health provides access to medication proven to help. A daily pill to drink less or to quit drinking altogether. Text News Nation to 710-710 to learn more.
Hey, look at that. They got one of DirecTV's new genre packs.
I think you mean genre packs.
Yeah, that's what I said. Now they can pay less and pick just the TV they want.
Pick the TV they want.
Yeah, now you're getting the picture.
I give up.
Day 85, April 15th. Payback for Tish James. The Federal Housing Finance Agency refers New York State Attorney General Letitia James for federal prosecution on mortgage fraud charges.
A crooked AG, Letitia James.
Remember, it was James who campaigned on bringing charges against Donald Trump. And then in 2024, proceeded to win a massive civil fraud judgment against him for inflating the value of his properties on loan applications.
We will prove our case. I thank you all for being here, and again, justice will prevail.
And what happened on April 15th is emblematic of one of this young administration's defining traits, a thirst for payback.
Letitia James is one of the most corrupt, shameless individuals ever to hold public office.
The enemy's list is long. Law firms, generals, former advisors. Call it revenge or retribution, but rest assured, if you've crossed this president, your comeuppance is coming due.
Going after Tish James, the investigations, give me the analysis. What's the no spin?
You know, I would probably do some of that if I were Trump, but I know it's all personal with Trump. You heard him and his family, he's going to come get you.
Is it good for the country?
Not particularly.
The great presidents, Washington probably in particular, but I think you can put Lincoln in that as well, put country above self. Is Donald Trump capable of that?
I don't know. That's too broad a question. But you're wrong when you said that Lincoln and Washington were benevolent in this area. Every president settled scores. Washington hung four guys.
Isn't that what used to make America different, though, is we didn't do it in this way?
But we did it this way.
No.
We always did. Oh, come on. What are you, Little Bo Peep?
I love America. Every president
did it.
Not like this.
Yo, whoa. These guys, you cross them, they're coming after you.
They were putting guys in jail.
Ooh, John Adams? How many journalists did he put in jail?
You want to go back to the 1780s?
Is that our country?
Modern times.
Is he a president?
How many political enemies did Reagan put in jail? Or Bush?
Reagan took care of some people, big time. And the Bush boys, You don't want to get on the wrong side of those guys.
W invaded Iraq.
Look, it's not about putting people in jail. It's about auditing them with the IRS. Okay? It's about making their business have a few more regulations.
But isn't that where we're headed? Feels like
we're there. We're always there.
So now we're going to be like Italy.
I hope not, other than the cuisine. But you're naive if you don't think that these presidents, Dwight Eisenhower, you cross him, boy, somebody was going to be knocking on your door. I mean, these
O'Reilly thinks I'm too idealistic.
They had the television way down, and I said to our great first lady, listen, did I just hear I was being impeached again?
What's going to be Donald Trump's legacy?
Depends how well he does on the economy. Look, to end this hour, and I hope people enjoyed it because it's an honest hour, his second term is ill-defined. However, it's not going to take 4 years to define it. It's going to have to be defined by this time next year.
Before the midterms.
He loses the midterms. The Democrats are going to come after him with everything possible. And he's going to get nothing done the next 2 years. So is he got 1 year from now to make America prosperous. And that's what it's all about.
So there you have it. However you're feeling about Donald Trump's return to the White House, exhilarated, exasperated, exhausted, get used to it. Because after this action-packed first 100 days, we still have exactly 1,361 days of President Trump ahead of us. Will you be better off when he leaves office? There are no guarantees with Trump, except you won't be bored. I'm Leland Vitter. For all of us here at News Nation, thanks for watching and good night.
Everybody, welcome to Friday Night. You made it through the week. It's really good to have you here. I've got some incredible stories for you tonight. First and foremost, if you were with me last night, you saw me almost lose my mind over that story out of Albuquerque that involved an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 15-year-old doing this, joyriding in a stolen car and deciding, hey, that cyclist up ahead, let's bump him. Yeah, bump him. Bump him. And so bump him they did. And he was killed. Took a year to find those three kids. Again, 11 years old. The driver was 12, is now 13. And the kid in the back with the camera, that one was 15. So this is the victim, 63 years old, a man who was a scientist on his way to his lab, working at 4 o'clock in the morning, riding his bike, helping Homeland Security, in fact, with his research. So we lost that American. But the 13-year-old, again, who was 12 when he was behind the wheel of the stolen car, his lawyer is on with me tonight. And I have so many questions for him about this kid, about the deal that he struck, and why on earth this kid, even though he's going to spend 8 years in juvenile detention till he's 21, why he gets out without being called a murderer, without even having officially committed a crime on paper. And also questions about these other two as well. So that's coming up. And then also I've got a question for you. And this is an honest question. It's not a riddle. I really, really want to sample what you think about this. How much time in prison do you think is appropriate for someone who is selling like a teaspoonful of cocaine, and not like dealing it to strangers and all the rest, to someone he knows? Do you think like 6 months in prison? Do you think 6 years? How about 60? How about 60 years in prison for selling less than an ounce of cocaine? The man on that bulletin board is Michael Edwards. And I can tell you right now, when I got into my career, he did that crime and he's been in prison ever since. FYI, I'm going on to like year 38 as a journalist. That's Michael now. He's like 62. So he's already been behind bars for over 30 years. And he's still got the other half of his sentence to go. Like, if he stays behind bars for that spoonful of cocaine, he won't get out until he's in his 70s because of good time. And when I say good time, this has been the model prisoner. This guy has a squeaky clean record. Tonight, I am talking to the state attorney who put him away. The state attorney who says enough is enough. This guy should not be in prison anymore. Why are taxpayers even paying for this? Are we really what we were in the 90s? Get tough on, you know, three strikes, war on drugs, just say no. Are we still those people? Should a Michael Edwards be rotting in prison for 6 decades for a spoonful of cocaine? His family's also here tonight. You will hear from them and what they've been through. And then this is a case of road rage I can't even begin to describe. It's hard to even show it. Pennsylvania woman, she sort of went really next level being upset with the car behind her. I can only just show you the video. So let's take it full and have a peek. Yeah, that happened. That actually happened. And what you see is what you think it is. She had did some business on the car behind her. Who is this woman? And what did she say when she was arrested? Wait until you hear what she's been charged with. And again, what she said as she was being locked up and put away for that particular crime. All right, let's start here. If you steal a car and you run down a cyclist on purpose for fun, and that person dies, you are likely going to prison for life. And society will call that a win, probably for two reasons. First, you deserve it. And second, we'd all be protected with you being locked away. Kind of makes sense, right? But what if a kid does it? And when I say kid, I mean a 12-year-old kid. Certainly he needs to be punished, and we need to be protected from someone like that. But a kid that young, they barely know right from wrong. And yet, when 12-year-old Jonathan Overbay swerved his stolen car into a 63-year-old man for fun, he had to know that that man could get terribly hurt. And that is exactly what happened, but worse. The man was killed. Overbay has since turned 13, because it has been almost a year since he and two of his buddies, one of them 15 and the other one just 11, killed that cyclist who was on his way to work in Albuquerque. You've seen this awful video, I'm sure, a dozen times. It was shot by the teenager sitting in the back seat while the 11-year-old egged on Jonathan to bump him. And him was Scott Habermill, a 63-year-old nuclear physicist who worked at the Sandia National Laboratory. As we told you last night, 13-year-old Jonathan pleaded guilty this week to second-degree murder. But here's the rub. I've seen the paperwork, and in the eyes of the law in New Mexico, he did not officially commit a crime, per se, because at the tender age of 12/13, he admitted to and was sentenced for something called a delinquent act. And what is the sentence for a boy who deliberately rammed a 63-year-old cyclist and killed him? Confinement in New Mexico's juvenile system until he turns 21. 8 years, that's the max. As for the other kids in the car who laughed and waved a gun and posted a murder online and stayed quiet about it for a year, their days are coming. And that includes the youngest one, an 11-year-old, a child named Messiah Hayes. The Albuquerque DA told me right here last night that when Messiah turns 12, and that is about 3 weeks from now, a very grown-up charge will be waiting for him.
I will tell you that 11-year-old will be charged with murder. When he turns 12 years old, he will be charged with murder. We need to do everything we can to make sure we hold these young kids accountable when they do something like this and protect the community. And it's extremely frustrating. Times are changing. This isn't about a couple of kids fighting behind the high school anymore. This is about kids who are violently hurting and killing people on the streets of Albuquerque.
And when it comes to kids who are violently hurting and killing people, Michael Rosenfeld might just be the best person on the subject, because he is the attorney who secured the plea deal for 13-year-old Jonathan Overbay. Mr. Rosenfeld, thank you so much for being on the program. I have so many questions for you. Let me start with this one. Are you satisfied with the resolution in your client's case, with the punishment that he's received?
Yes, under our system of justice, a boy, and you have to understand that I've represented a number of people like Jonathan. These are not young men. These are boys. They have the minds of boys. Jonathan at the time was a preteen. And so you have to look at what is the best for a boy like Jonathan, what is the best for society in terms of what you call punishment to make sure that he doesn't do this again and that he understands what happened. And the system that we have now, he will go to a juvenile rehabilitation center until his 21st birthday, as you said, and then he'll be released. At that rehab center, hopefully he will get the counseling that he so sorely needs. He'll get the education that he doesn't have, and he will return to society, as everybody will, when they get out of either a locked-up facility for adults or for children. He'll return to society, hopefully better able to cope with some of the issues that he had before he committed this crime.
That's a huge issue for the people who are listening, especially those right now in Albuquerque, in his community, because I'm sure many people will agree, you're right, he was 12, but many others will say, I want to ride my bike, and I want to know I will live, and that someone isn't going to get out of juvenile and go back to the streets and do things like this or worse. How can we be sure that this boy will become a good man?
Well, we can't be sure. We can only do the best we can. CYFD runs this facility. I've been to that facility that he's going to. He's probably there already, and they do a good job there. But it's really important for people to understand. It's like with the death penalty. The argument used to be if you have the death penalty, it will deter violent crimes and people will not commit heinous murders because they know they're going to get executed. That's a false premise. It's been shown that it doesn't make any sense. It's not true. And it's the same thing with boys like Jonathan. And I've represented a number of these boys. They are boys. And almost every one of them comes from a dysfunctional family. They have a lot of them have no moral compass because they don't get one at home. These are not middle class children who were brought up in a home where mom and dad go to work in the morning and then they come home after school and they go to basketball or soccer or band practice like most normal middle-class kids. These are kids, you know, who come for the most part, and I'm not singling Jonathan out. You have to understand that this is, as Sam Bregman said last night, there are a lot of these kids out there, and they, for the most part, come from dysfunctional families, and they're moral compasses are not set straight in the home.
You just mentioned Sam Bregman, and I just want the viewers to know who you're talking about. That is the DA who was on the program last night, who said that there is a real crisis in the Albuquerque area and in New Mexico in particular, with youth on the street who are dangerous. I do want to ask you about this young man, Jonathan Overbay's mother, because she was in court. She gave an apology in court. She gave a statement. And I'm wondering what her exposure is here, because all over the country, we're starting to see prosecutors going after parents to say, if your kid does something like this and someone dies, we're going to look to you. Is she exposed? Might she be charged in this case?
Not right now. There's no law that I'm aware of in New Mexico that would make a parent liable for a child. We've seen in other states, parents are being held criminally liable if their children take firearms from the home and harm other people. Those states are trying to go after those parents. We don't have that in New Mexico right now.
I'll say this because Mr. Rosenfeld, people watching right now will say this happened at 4:30 in the morning and these kids were in a stolen car. One was 11, one was 12, one was 15. Where the hell were all three of their parents? And I'm going to take back asking about mom and whether she was exposed. Mom and dad. Why are mom and dad of Jonathan Overbay, who obviously failed this kid miserably, not going to have to account not only to their kid and the injustice that they gave him, but the injustice towards this victim's family?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. You're going to, the state legislatures are going to have to grapple with those kinds of questions. I'm aware of the family situation, but because of confidential communications, I cannot explain what happened in that home. But those are very important questions to ask.
Obviously, I think so many of us are starting to wonder if there's an epidemic of kids behaving this way. There's an epidemic of parents who yielded to this happening. I do want to ask you one thing, Mr. Rosenfeld, and that is in the negotiation with the DA's office about your client Jonathan Overbay's plea deal, one of the requests you made was that Jonathan is not going to testify against the other two in the car. Why is that?
Because sometimes the district attorneys will wait until after somebody who does not agree to testify against co-defendants enters a plea. Sometimes they're sentenced, sometimes they're not. And then the state will subpoena them to testify against the co-defendants at their trials, even though there was no agreement to do so. And when there is an agreement to do so, generally the judge gives a lighter sentence. But we wanted to make sure in this case, because Jonathan did not want to testify against either of the other, they're not actually not co-defendants or co-respondents, because it's not a criminal case per se. And he didn't want to do that, and that was part of the plea agreement.
It just pains me to hear he didn't want to do that. I sort of feel like his feelings shouldn't be incorporated into the metric at this point. You know, question. I only have 10 seconds left. He gets his record wiped clean, doesn't he? He comes out at 21 without any record at all, correct?
That's correct, because in our justice system, he's being prosecuted in juvenile court. He's not being charged with a crime. He's being charged with a delinquent act. He's not pleading guilty. He's admitting to a delinquent act. So the way the law works is that he hasn't, it won't affect his Second Amendment right, when he comes out of the juvenile facility at age 21.
It's extraordinarily frustrating. I'd love to have you back. It's a healthy conversation. There are definitely two sides to this. It's maddening on both sides. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Mr. Rosenfeld.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come tonight, a different kind of prisoner of war. The war the U.S. declared decades ago, spent billions fighting and basically lost, the war on drugs. And our prisons are full of dealers and addicts whose sentences were more about politics than justice. After a break, a Florida man who's been in prison for 31 years for selling one spoonful of cocaine. And he's still only halfway through his sentence. Is this really who we want locked up? The state attorney who put him away says, hell no. And he's live with me next, along with the prisoner's family. Friday. I did drugs in my younger days. I tried them anyway. I did weed and mushrooms in college, but I drew the line in the sand when it came to the hard stuff. And yet some of my friends indulged. And lucky for us, we all came away unscathed. Most of us anyway, not all of us. The war on drugs was in full swing back then. It was the 80s and a lot of people, thousands upon thousands, were locked up for a very long time for crimes that either aren't considered crimes today, or if they are, the sentences are a hell of a lot shorter. Case in point, Michael Edwards. In 1994, Michael was caught selling a spoonful of cocaine, less than an ounce, to an ex-girlfriend. The total cost of it was, I think, $850. But the ex-girlfriend had turned police informant, and Michael was arrested. Before the trial, Michael was offered a plea deal. 9 years in prison, but he turned it down because he was sure that he beat the rap. It was just a spoonful of cocaine, right? And then he was offered another deal, which was worse, 15 years in prison. So he turned that one down as well, opting for a trial. But at trial, Michael was found guilty. And when it came time to the sentence, they threw the book at him. 60 years in a Florida prison with no chance for parole. 60 years for a spoonful of cocaine. I should note that Michael was an addict, and this was his third arrest. All of them nonviolent, all of them for drugs. But they called it his third strike, and under the law, It was the 90s. It was a very different time.
Say yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
I remember that well. Tonight, Michael Edwards is still in prison, 31 years after his conviction. He has been a model prisoner and has shaved time off of his original sentence. But even then, he is not due for release until 2037. That is another 12 years from now, which would mean a grand total of 43 years for selling less than an ounce of cocaine to a friend. If he makes it, he will be 74 years old when he gets out. But he is hoping to do better than that. He is petitioning the courts for clemency. And the prosecutor who put him away believes it is time that Michael got out of prison. Michael's also petitioning political leaders, many who agree that he has served too much time, but not all of them. I'm joined now by Michael Edwards' sister, Mimi Edward Beach, and his mother, Alicia Allen, and by Joe D'Alessandro, who was the state attorney when Michael was convicted and jailed. Welcome to all of you, and I thank you so much for being here. It's such a critical story to tell. Mimi, let me begin with you, if I might. I want to ask you about your brother and your family. Sure. What have these 3 decades, been like for you all?
It's been horrible. I mean, I couldn't even begin to explain how disheartening and painful it is to speak to my brother on a daily basis, yet not being able to hold him, hug him, be with him, with my mom and myself. I don't even know if anybody can ever even imagine not being with somebody as long as it's been for us. And now that he's so far away, and then after COVID, we have not even been able to see him, except for on a video call for 15 minutes. And that doesn't really happen very often either. So it's difficult.
I mean, it's got to be pretty heartbreaking. I heard that during COVID, he was moved to another prison. It's 7 hours away. And so obviously that makes things pretty hard for family visits. Mimi, he turned down 2 different deals. Do you remember? I mean, it's a long time to go back. But do you remember those heady days and why he was so sure it was a good idea to turn down 9 years and then 15 years?
Well, his state of mind in that time of his life, I mean, he was a drug addict. Just felt that he was going to be able to not so much get away with it, but he also had where there was an affidavit that the girlfriend turned informant had signed and saying that she had lied. So at that point as well, Michael was confident. Why should I concede to or agree to a plea when the witness is saying that she lied? And that was the only real evidence that they had against him. So it was very surprising that the jury found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, with a lot of evidence that didn't seem, the numbers didn't make sense, to be honest with you. But for Michael too, I just think that he had gotten away with a lot of things throughout his years. And he just thought that this was going to be another one that he would be. Why should I concede to do the 15 years when I'm going to win this case? So that's how it went.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you, I could not believe it when I learned the detail that the ex-girlfriend informant upon sentencing took her life. That's yeah. Another detail in this case that I think is just so incredibly overwhelming. It's just so many people victimized, I think, in this case. Alicia, this is probably just such an incredibly difficult thing for you to do, interview on television about your son. And Mimi, help her if there's a hearing issue at all. I know it's a struggle. But I just wanted to ask Alicia, did you ever think it was possible, even close, to your son getting a sentence that long?
She was asking if you ever thought it would, this would have ever happened with Michael getting a sentence for this time.
Oh, no, I never imagined such a thing.
It's hard to even for a parent to have this happen to them, to be without their son. It's taken a real toll on my mom, and especially these last couple of years, it's getting harder and harder. When we went to clemency, we really expected at the hearing that Michael would be coming home with us. I mean, to the point that I packed up a bag of clothes and everything. We were confident that he would be coming home with us, and we're so excited. And that was 5 years ago. So it's been another 5 years of just the struggles of not having him here with us. It's very difficult.
And from what I understand, several politicians, high-level politicians in Florida, as well as people with the clemency board, voted in favor of your brother being released. And it was one stroke of the pen, only just a couple of words from Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm not inclined at this time, next. I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear that. Let me bring in Joe DeAlessandro. Mr. DeAlessandro, you were the state attorney at the time that this happened, and you've since changed your thinking and feel that Michael should be released. What changed your thinking?
Well, that's a whole lot of things. It's very difficult to pinpoint it all one. But I became very much aware that he was serving more time than really he should have served. That's what got me really involved. When I had a lot of correspondence with Mr. Edwards. I knew his family, know his family. That doesn't mean anything as far as my ability to prosecute. But I became acquainted with him and listened to him and as a prosecutor for 36 years. And I decided, reached the point that he had served too much time. The law has changed. Three strikes and you're out. We don't use it anymore. It may be on books in Florida, but to my knowledge, they don't use it anymore. And that had a big influence on me. I've been trying for many years to help him. I even got a friend of mine who's an attorney in Tallahassee, because I live here far away, to go see him and try to represent him at parole hearings and try to get him out. I don't think he should be in prison. And
Mr. DeAlessandro, can I ask you this? I know that 5 years ago, Governor DeSantis in Florida passed up the opportunity to grant clemency. I don't know if this is a get tough on crime thing, but I'm not exactly sure what we're trying to get tough on at this point. But I know that also Michael is reaching out to President Trump for any kind of help that he might be able to give this case. From your perspective, having been a state attorney, is there anything that President Trump can do in his relationship with Ron DeSantis to move the needle on this absolutely ridiculous case?
Legally, I don't think there is anything that the president can do because it's not a federal crime. But you can still talk to people, try to reason with people. He can talk to, I would assume, Governor DeSantis, just pick up the phone and talk to him. I'm not able to do that. I'm retired. I can't just make a phone call and people, oh, yeah, gee, I'll answer it. He can do that.
Well,
but that's up to him. I haven't spoken to him. I haven't tried to. I haven't done that, no.
Well, you know what? I'm just going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to suggest Mr. DeAlessandro do it. Call him. Let him know who you are. You matter. You were instrumental in this case ending up the way it is, and I think your opinions should matter. We all change. We evolve in the justice system, and I think we can all agree. And maybe there's viewers who don't, and I'm sorry, but they're, for the grace of God, go I. This is an injustice. The taxpayers in Florida are being raked a new one as well. They're paying for someone they shouldn't be paying to incarcerate, and I think this man deserves a second chance. Edwards Beach, Alicia Allen, and Joe DeAlessandro, thank you. I'd like to continue to follow this. I'd like to have you back. Thank you all for this.
Thank you.
Thank you. The one thing I'd like to say, in my whole entire career, I've never tried to get somebody's sentence vacated or commuted or anything, except Mr. Edwards. I don't belong. He served his time. Justice has been done in this case. As far as I'm concerned, he shouldn't be in prison.
I appreciate you being honest and candid and transparent about that. I think it's a huge statement. Thank you again. I do appreciate it. And again, we will continue to follow this case. And I'm going to make a few calls as well. Coming up, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Prosecution in the Karen Reed retrial knows that saying better than anyone. And it seems their star witness had also taken it to heart, because she was back on the stand today determined to take down her one-time friend, who would a choice word for her after court ended. And if you happen to encounter any road rage this weekend, please, please take a deep breath, stay in your car, and thank your lucky stars that the cops have arrested the infamous Delco Pooper. You heard me. Pooper. Buckle up. We are flush with details about the charges she's facing. And here's a hint. Depositing waste on the highway doesn't always mean litter. It's all next. The end of this week, then, Jennifer McCabe. Jen was a close friend of a Boston cop named John O'Keefe, and she just wrapped up three grueling days on the witness stand in the retrial of Karen Reed, O'Keefe's alleged killer. And those last hours on the stand were grueling. Karen's hotshot lawyer grilled Jen McCabe over what happened the morning that she and Karen and a third woman found the victim lying frozen in the snow in her sister's front yard, and why nobody from inside that sister's house came out to help.
All you knew was there was a severely injured man on the front lawn of their house, and your sister didn't answer the phone, not once, but twice, correct?
Correct, she didn't answer the phone.
Did you think your sister might have been in peril? Did you think to go inside the house and check that they're okay?
I had no reason to think that they weren't okay.
You had no reason to believe they weren't okay. A man was dead, dying on their lawn, and your sister not answering the phone. And nobody is coming out to the chaos of Karen Reed screaming on the front lawn.
After court ended, Karen Reed called Jen McCabe the quarterback of an alleged plot to frame her for her boyfriend's death. We'll keep following it, folks. And coming up, a little girl grows up without a father and always wonders why he left. Now, more than 30 years later, a shocking discovery. Actually, two. Daniel Halloran did not disappear by choice. And his death is part of a much, much bigger story. The creepy story of the Fox Hollow Farm, a killing field with an indoor pool surrounded by mannequins. We have a huge update in the saga of this serial killer. Next. Halloran when she was growing up. She never knew her father. He left the family in 1993 when Carl wasn't even two. And they never heard from him again. And neither did anyone else, as it turns out. This week, the world learned that Carl's dad was not a deadbeat. He was a murder victim. And not just any murder victim, a serial killer's victim. The coroner of Hamilton County, Indiana, has just declared that Daniel Thomas Halloran is the 10th known victim of the horrors at Fox Hollow Farm. When young men started disappearing in and around Indianapolis in the mid-1980s, all the way through till the mid-1990s, it didn't go completely unnoticed. Flyers would go up on the walls of the local gay bars. Friends would reach out to other friends. But at a time when AIDS was ravaging gay communities everywhere, when seeing somebody one day and then never seeing them again became almost normal, it is fair to say that what was really happening in Indy did not get the attention it deserved. Apart from a deadly plague, gay people lived, as many live now, with the ever-present fear of being outed, of losing a job or a family, if one dared to be their true self in public. But in 1994,
one man did come forward with chilling accounts of a man who called himself Brian. The man said Brian frequented Indianapolis gay bars, luring men back to his home to keep the party going, which in his case meant strangling, erotic asphyxiation, and maybe much worse. The man said it happened to him, that Brian took him to a lavish home with an indoor pool. But the pool was bizarre. It was staged with male mannequins. And Brian's request? That was even more bizarre. He asked to be strangled as part of an erotic kink. And of course, he wanted to reciprocate. The man said that was his cue. He got out of there fast. And sadly, could not remember where the house was. But 1 year later, he ran into Brian again. And this time he took down the license plate number, which led detectives to a place called Fox Hollow Farm, home of a local businessman who owned a chain of thrift stores. That man was a family man with a wife that he'd met at Indiana University and three children, a boy and two girls. His name was Herb Baumeister. Police asked to search Baumeister's property, all 18 acres of it. But Baumeister refused, said no. What they didn't know then was that Mrs. Baumeister, Julie, already had some suspicions of her own. Around the time of the tipster's narrow escape from Brian, Brian with the creepy pool staged with mannequins, the Baumeister's 13-year-old son had found a human skull in the woods near the house. Herb Baumeister laughed it off. He said it was from a skeleton that his father, an anesthesiologist, had since med school. Police didn't have enough for a search warrant, but for a second time, they asked if they could come in and poke around. And this time they asked Julie. And they told Julie about Herb's secret life. But the answer to police was still the same. No way. Get out. Months went by and the Baumeister's marriage fell apart. There were money problems on top of everything else. And in June of 1996, while Herb was out of town, Julie okayed a search. And what police unearthed over two solid weeks was staggering.
People just have missing people, and they've heard that we have found human remains on the property here, and they're just inquiring as to what we have and letting us know who is missing out of their families or what it might be, what their questions are.
Investigators found more than 10,000 burned and crushed human remains, bones and pieces of bones. There were jaw bones with teeth still attached, found in a stream bed. There was an arm bone with a handcuff still on it. Police would estimate the bones belonged to at least 25 individual victims. By 1999, 8 of those victims would have names. But Herb Baumeister, he was long gone. He disappeared just one day into the search of Fox Hollow Farm. But he wouldn't be gone too long. His body turned up in Ontario, Canada, several days later.
Police found the remains of 5 people on Baumeister's Hamilton County estate. Last week, Baumeister killed himself in a park in Ontario, Canada. Investigators have told News 8 he shot himself in the head.
There was a suicide note, but it only mentioned Baumeister's failing marriage and struggling business. Nothing about his secret life at the gay clubs, and nothing about a secret life as a serial killer. And from 1999 to 2022, almost a quarter century, the investigation itself almost died. But then came Eric Pranger.
My aunt was ready to give up years ago. She's made several calls, like before Jeff was there, and she just lost hope. Then I made the phone call, and we were able to reopen the case and get results.
Eric Pranger's cousin was Alan Livingston, a young gay man who disappeared in 1993 and fit the profile of Baumeister's known victims. Cousin Eric wanted closure for Alan Livingston's mom and pushed the authorities to test more of the Fox Hollow bones using 21st century science. The coroner of Hamilton County obliged. He chose 44 fragments out of 10,000 and began the now familiar process of genetic genealogy. And amazingly, Alan Livingston was the very first match that was made. But Daniel Halloran was matched to his mother, who died 2 years ago of a drug overdose, and remarkably, whose DNA was on file. Coming up, one of the crappiest days a Pennsylvania woman has ever had. No joke. Okay, so this is live TV. This happens all the time. And if you've had a crappy week, I'm now having a crappy week. Because I'm about to tell you about the crappy week that lady had in Pennsylvania. So hold it for a second. We just had like a meltdown of video. But if you were watching as we went into the break, you saw that this lady was pooping on a car. So here is the story. And I am still working to get the broken piece of videotape back, you know, taped together. But there are two women who are perhaps having a crappier week than I'm having right now. And I'm just not exactly sure which woman is having a crappier week. But I want to take you to Prospect Park in Pennsylvania for this. It's outside of Philadelphia. This woman was driving a black car and had some road rage with the lady in the silver car behind her. And so her decision about being angry was to get out of her car and go back to the silver car and make the silver car, a little less silver. Her actual choice in her road rage weapon was her own butt. It's hard to believe this, but before the evidence was even dry, social media decided that this lady needed to be called the Delco Pooper. Delco as in Delaware County. And because of the actual video, which I'm trying to still splice together and roll for you, the police, just like the pooper, had something to go on. See what I did there? And it wasn't long before they actually got to the bottom of the story and the crime. I'm like full of these puns, by the way. The bottom of the crime in question belongs to Christina Solomento, 42 years old. She is facing charges of indecent exposure, disorderly conduct, criminal mischief, property damage, harassment, and get ready for this one, depositing waste on a highway. The waste that she deposited was actually poop on the silver car. She literally pooped on the hood of the silver car behind her. Story's a little weirder because Ms. Solomon, or Solomon,